Ladies and gentlemen, good day and welcome to the Roundtable Plus webinar on Do's and Don'ts for M&As in India Pharma and Healthcare Sector. This event is being organized by Nishit Desai Associates in association with our supporting partner, AIBI, Association of Investment Bankers of India. The speakers are Dr. Milind Antani, Partner, Pharma and Healthcare Practice Group, Nishit Desai Associates, Gauri Gokhale, Partner, Pharma and IP, Nishit Desai Associates, Nishal Joshipura, Partner, Private Equity and MA, Nishit Desai Associates, Simone Rees, Co-Head of Mergers and Acquisitions and Private Equity Practice, Nishit Desai Associates. As a reminder, all participant lines will be in the listen-only mode. There'll be an opportunity for you to ask questions at the end of today's discussion. If you need assistance during the conference call, please signal an operator by pressing star, then zero on your touchtone phone. Also, you can download our applet Nishit Mobile, which is available on the App Store for iOS device, Play Store for Android, and BlackBerry World to access our current updates and videos. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I would now like to hand the session over to Mr. Nishal Joshipura. Thank you, and over to you, sir.
Thanks. Welcome to all the participants joining this roundtable and webinar. In today's session on mergers and acquisitions in Indian pharmaceutical and healthcare sector, we will be discussing, among other things, the typical deal structures that we have seen in the M&A space in pharma sector, the foreign investment and the competition law issues that have been plaguing the M&As in Indian pharmaceutical sector, the regulatory challenges and the intellectual property related issues, which are extremely important for any acquirer to understand in detail before consummating any acquisition in the Indian pharmaceutical sector. We'll also be discussing the do's and don'ts which any acquirer should follow for making any acquisition in the Indian pharma space. Before we move to the Indian pharmaceutical sector, we'll spend some time on how M&As have been happening in the global pharmaceutical industry. So if you see the last 1 year, there has been a spurt in the global M&A activity in the pharmaceutical sector. The first half of 2015 saw $221 billion worth of pharmaceutical M&A is happening, which was almost thrice of what happened in the first half of 2014. Some of the key reasons why we saw the spurt in the global M&A activity in the pharmaceutical sector are as follows. The first important reason is the availability of cheap debt. Globally, the interest rates have been low, which has resulted in cheap debt being available for acquisition of pharmaceutical companies. Which means the big ticket acquisitions which we have seen in the last 1 year, majority of these acquisitions were funded through cheap debt that was available to the acquirers. The second key reason for spurt in the global M&A activity has been what we call the concept of corporate inversions. Globally, the pharma companies are looking at inverting their corporate structure in a manner where their effective tax rate can reduce. We saw Pfizer making a bid on AstraZeneca, which was about $118 billion. Although that acquisition didn't go through, the intent behind that bid was to invert the corporate structure of Pfizer from US to UK. US is a high-tax jurisdiction and UK is a low-tax jurisdiction. So the corporate inversion made a lot of sense for Pfizer. In case the transaction would have got consummated and Pfizer would have moved its corporate structure to UK, which has tax rate of just 20-21%. The third major reason why we saw a spurt in the M&A activity has been the investor or the shareholder activism. The classic case for this was Bill Ackman, who runs Pershing Square, which is a hedge fund. What Bill Ackman did was he acquired stake in Allergan, which is a large pharmaceutical company. and he started building his stake in that company and teamed up with Valiant, which is a Canadian company, to acquire Allergan. Now, what happened because of that was the stock price of Allergan moved up, and even though Valiant could not consummate the acquisition of Allergan, ultimately Activist, which is an Irish company, acquired Allergan. But what happened because of this was because Bill Ackman, who was the shareholder Activist, pushed Allergan and Valiant to do a transaction. When Activist acquired Allergan, Bill Ackman and his hedge fund Pershing Square exited at a huge premium. And there are many more pharma companies which are being pushed by the shareholder Activist to do transactions to generate shareholder value. So this is another reason why we have been seeing spurt in the global M&A activity. The fourth reason has been US FDA has become very stringent in giving approvals, on account of which it makes a lot of sense to acquire companies which already have existing FDA approvals. So we have seen some of the acquisitions happening on account of the prolonged process for getting FDA approvals. And the fifth major reason why we have been seeing spurt in the activities because a lot of patents for blockbuster drugs have been expiring on a periodic basis, which means the acquirers need to keep churning out their portfolio and relooking at their portfolio to ensure that the patented products which have reasonable or a substantial life before expiry can be exploited to generate more revenues. Within the global M&A activity in the pharmaceutical space, what we also saw was there were a lot of hostile bids which were launched by the acquirers. The major hostile bid, which was one of the most important hostile bids that was launched and which is considered to be, you know, a three-way battle for hostile bids, was when Mylan made a hostile bid on Perrigo for acquiring Perrigo for about $29 billion at 25% premium. But what happened was when Mylan made this hostile bid on Perrigo, Teva made a hostile bid on Mylan. So the acquirer in one transaction became a target in the other transaction. Although the deal didn't go through for Teva, Teva was not able to acquire Mylan because Mylan successfully used poison pills under the Dutch regime to thwart the hostile bid from Teva. But this clearly shows the wave of hostile acquisitions that are in offing, and you know, that will take place in you know, the next 6 to 12 months in the global M&A space in the pharmaceutical sector. As far as India is concerned, the Indian pharmaceutical sector contributes to about 2.4% of the global pharmaceutical sector by value and about 10% by volume. A couple of major deals in the Indian pharmaceutical space which we saw were Sun Pharma's acquisition of Ranbaxy, which was structured as a merger of Ranbaxy into Sun Pharma, and Lupin's acquisition of Gavin and Novel, which was again about $800 million acquisition. The Lupin's acquisition was the largest outbound pharma deal by an Indian pharma company, which earlier was Dr. Reddy's acquisition of Beta Pharm in Germany in 2007. Although that deal didn't do well on account of the change in the regulatory regime by the German regulators, where, you know, pricing became a concern for, you know, for selling the products in Germany. But with Lupin's acquisition of Gavin and Novel, we might see a spurt in the outbound M&A activity in the pharma sector by Indian companies. One of the perceptions globally with respect to Indian pharma companies has been that Indian pharma companies are not great at compliance, which is also one of the reasons why the Indian pharma companies haven't been able to get the FDA approvals fast from the US authorities. And the numbers clearly suggest that that's something which is happening, because the US FDA approvals received by Indian pharma companies in the financial year 2013-14 were 102 as compared to 56 in the financial year 2014-15. So clearly, one of the reasons why the Indian pharma companies are also looking at global acquisitions is access to companies which already have US FDA approvals, and Lupin's acquisition of Gavin is also one of the classic examples, where Gavin is awaiting almost FDA approval for 66 of its products, which could come anytime. So if these approvals come through, then you know it will be a good acquisition for Lupin, because they'll be able to hit the market faster as compared to some of the other competitors. So broadly, this is how the Indian pharmaceutical market and the global pharmaceutical market have been shaping up as far as the mergers and acquisition activity is concerned. What we will do now is we'll move on to the question and answer session with the other panelists. My first question is to Dr. Milind Anthony. Dr. Anthony, you have worked in the pharmaceutical, you've been part of the pharmaceutical industry for almost more than 15 years, and since the last decade, you have been also advising a lot of pharmaceutical companies on legal and regulatory issues. Would you like to throw some light on how do you see the Indian pharmaceutical and the healthcare industry shaping up, and what's the future of the industry?
Sure. Thanks, Nishal. I think before I really go on to how it is shaping up, let us first see how exactly the pharmaceutical sector as well as the healthcare sector is operating in India. So first I will just discuss on pharmaceutical sector. If you see, the pharmaceutical sector in India is very broad-based and highly fragmented, because it operates on various fronts like APIs, which is bulk drug manufacturing, where India is one of the largest manufacturer and supplier of APIs to the world. At the same time, India is predominantly a generic formulation manufacturer, though we have seen many branded generic and generic-generic combinations coming out. And recently, what we have seen is that a lot of emphasis is given by even domestic players as well as global players to emphasize on lifestyle products, which covers oncology, which is cancer treatments, diabetes, hypertension, and neurological things, where we see a lot of focus. Another very promising area where we have seen a lot of activities, and you also mentioned on pipeline getting dried up with a lot of patents getting expired in next few years. India has been a predominantly a CRAMS player. CRAMS is a contract research, manufacturing, and services. So primarily, India emerged as providing contract research at preclinical stage, mainly on medicinal chemistry side. But last few years, we have seen India becoming very active on biologic side, where a lot of CROs are very active on vaccines and other biologic products. On CRAMS also, we have seen a lot of companies who are only on contract manufacturing side, like Sashuns and other companies which are there. On CRO, we have GVK Bioscience and other CROs which are very active, but they contribute significantly. Though not pharma, but a lot of pharmaceutical companies have also started looking at venturing into biologic space and coming out with a concept of biopharmaceuticals, which is becoming a very major portion of their business strategy, where these companies have started having some biologic R&D as well as manufacturing process, and the concept of biosimilars, as it is known as the similar biologics globally, which are generics in biology space, where Indian government also has become very conducive to this environment, and they are really helping them out. On healthcare side, again, it is a very highly fragmented sector, I would say. The healthcare services in India primarily, divided in India. Hospital sector plays a very major, where they are healthcare service providers serving through various types of hospitals. Then we have diagnostics, where a lot of laboratories provide diagnostic services. And another two areas which is fast emerging is on medical equipment as well as medical device sector. Medical device sector in India today is primarily import-driven. There are very few manufacturers in India, but most of the business is happening from foreign companies having their entity here and selling and distributing their products to various different models, which have become very important for the various companies. And again, on medical device, as you know, Indian government, the new Indian government has emphasized a lot on manufacturing in India and started with a Make in India initiative. And medical device is one of the areas where government is giving a lot of emphasis, and they are looking at creating a friendly environment for global players to come to India and manufacture, not only to cater Indian market, but manufacture in India, import to other markets, their existing market. So these are the existing sectors. I'll go back to, again, hospital sector, where almost 70 to 80% of the healthcare services provided by private sector, unlike other governments where there are specific programs. And that has given significant nidus to various big companies or global hospitals looking at India. We have seen many global hospitals tying up with Indian hospitals and coming out with either joint venture or acquiring or doing some kind of collaborations with Indian hospitals. So looking at all this, I personally feel what is going to happening and likely to happen very soon is a consolidation. And I think consolidation is something which is really going to play a significant role in first of all, bringing all these fragmented sectors together. Whether it's a small company or a large company, all have some strengths and weaknesses. So by this consolidation, there would be some synergy created and win-win situation will happen. There are very small companies like Suven Life Science and Biologic Sectors, which is very predominantly IP-driven company. They have many patents in India as well as foreign jurisdiction are going to play a significant role. So this is what the consolidation is going to play a significant role, where we see a lot of mergers, acquisition, either merger or acquisition happening. At the same time, we see some kind of a collaboration where ultimately they want to create a winning market for both the players. It's likely to happen. And if you really ask me what are the potential targets which have emerged so far as far as consolidation, especially M&A activity is concerned, we expect that companies which are very active on low cost and high R&D, as you very rightly mentioned, that companies are looking at focusing more on research and development, as drying pipeline is a global problem in pharma industry. So they are looking at tying up with Indian companies, and now Indian companies also have a significant pipeline molecules in various domains, whether it is oncology or cardiology on hypertension or even diabetes also. We have Zydus Cadila coming out with their own indigenous molecules very recently launched. So these are the areas where we see a lot of activities happening, there are potential targets. CRAMS is another area where we are seeing a lot of companies would look at getting merged or acquiring CROs which are very active into certain place and focused on developing new molecules. So these are the existing things, but on healthcare side, I think two areas are emerging very fast, and we have seen a lot of activities in the last 2 months only, which is MedTech. Some people call it MedTech, some people call it e-health, or it is a telemedicine. It's a blend of all telemedicine. It's a kind of a online healthcare services provided to patients towards access of healthcare. That is a good objective, and that is where we have seen lots of movements happening. A lot of players are coming, though there are certain regulatory issues because there are no specific laws that govern telemedicine, but there are various laws that govern individual part of the telemedicine and e-health, where we have seen recently a lot of activities happening, where recently 5 days ago a Pacto acquired one overseas company. There are private equity investments happening into this sector, and I'm expecting a lot of consolidation in this e-health or e-health sector, where they all will provide synergy to each other to create win-win situations. So coming back to what exactly I would like to say, that Indian pharmaceutical and healthcare market is expanding very fast and is very much ripe for such transactions. Mm-hmm. End of the day, the objective is to create a synergy where one player wants to work with another player to create a win-win situation.
Sure. Thanks, Dr. Anthony. So, Simon, as Dr. Anthony mentioned about the increasing transactions in the pharma M&A space, you have been advising a lot of clients on the deal structures. Would you like to throw some light on the typical deal structures that you have used in the M&A in pharma sector?
Sure. So I think in terms of these structures, you know, involve we need to look at, you know, some basic laws. One is, of course, the Companies Act to determine, you know, how you comply with the Companies Act in terms of what shareholder resolutions you require. That's one mother legislation. The next one would be for deals that are on the listed space, you need to comply with certain SEBI requirements and certain stock exchange requirements. The third is for foreign deals, you need to comply with the FEMA laws and the FDI requirements. The regulator, the Competition Commission of India, the regulator has been extremely active, especially in pharma deals. So in pharma deals, you also need to comply with competition, the Competition Act. Not that it doesn't apply to other deals, but given the magnitude of deals that we're seeing in terms of size and in terms of companies that actually have the bandwidth to actually acquire, these deals have been succumbed to a lot of scrutiny by the regulator. Of course, you always have, you know, tax as a forefront to see how you need to acquire a certain asset. And with the pharmaceutical industry, you also need to be wary of certain regulatory hurdles that you may have to cross, which, you know, you need to factor into the entire structure. So given this entire ambit, I think, let's discuss the simpliciter deal structure, which is a mere acquisition of shares by one entity from another. Now, assuming today you have...
Just before that, so we have sent a slide deck, which has four slides on four different structures. So the participants can have a look at the slide deck.
Yeah, so looking at slide deck number one, where you have the foreign acquirer and the Indian target. Now, we're looking at foreign acquirer merely because you have other implications in terms of FEMA to be looked at as opposed to just domestic laws. So as we know, of late, the FDI policy has been sort of amended to ensure that investments of FDI into brownfield pharmaceutical industry requires FIPB approval. Greenfield pharma still comes under the automatic route. So any acquisition of shares of voting rights in an entity that is engaged in brownfield pharma requires to go to the FIPB. So any structure that involves acquisition of shares of an Indian target by a foreign acquirer or a foreign owned or controlled company requires the approval of the FIPB. Now, a good example to give in terms of a foreign acquirer acquiring an Indian target would be the Daiichi Ranbaxy case, which was a simpliciter share acquisition. Of course, like I said, if you have a listed company, you have other concerns and compliances that you need to bear in mind. In that situation, the question was, can you transact on the market? Do you have to transact off the market? And what are the benefits of transacting on the market or off the market? Again, in that situation, in a listed company where you have a foreign acquirer, because FDI investors cannot really buy or trade or buy on the market, really speaking, you have to do a transaction that is off the market. In terms of marrying the stock exchange requirements and FIPB, what becomes very important is whether or not you have a non-compete requirement under the provisions of your deal. Because any investment or any FDI investment into a pharmaceutical company, if you have a non-compete, the FIPB looks at it even more stringently, and you require specific approval from the FIPB if you have a specific non-compete. So in terms of other requirements from a FEMA perspective, you have pricing requirements that need to be complied with. As you know, any sale of shares from a resident to a non-resident has to be at a minimum price that is determined in accordance with international or any international valuation parameters. Any acquisition by a foreign acquirer from another foreign shareholder of an Indian target does not need to meet these pricing requirements. In terms of acquisition of shares, we've talked about FIPB, and we'll probably deal with FIPB as to how you know, it looked at the Sun Pharma brand back CTS, maybe when we discuss other structures. So I think the next structure that we look at is a foreign acquirer acquiring a foreign target, a global M&A deal that happens to also include the Indian subsidiary. And a good example, you mentioned this, Nishchal, a little while ago in terms of the Teva Allegran transaction, where Teva, you know, has agreed to acquire the generic business of Allegran, has gone through with that. The consequences is that even though this is a global M&A deal, you have an implication in India, meaning to say that, you know, the Indian assets also get attracted here. Let's look at the laws that get attracted in such a deal. The Companies Act may not really, you know, come into being because this is acquisition of shares or voting rights offshore and doesn't really include an Indian company. If this is the FIPB also may not really come into being, especially if you're acquiring an offshore company directly outside, because the FIPB only comes into or you need to deal with the FIPB only if you are acquiring shares in the Indian company or holding rights in the Indian company. The third, however, regulator is the Competition Commission of India. Now, previously there was a specific exemption which said that if a deal was happening offshore and didn't have any correlation in India, didn't really have any activity in India, such a deal, you know, if it met the various thresholds under the Competition Act, did not require a filing in India. However, that exemption has now been withdrawn. And any deal that has an offshore deal wherein, you know, the target meets the thresholds under the Competition Act, you would need to make a filing in India as well. Very important there is the timing of that filing, because it triggers within 30 days of entering into an agreement to acquire. The fourth, of course, Nishchal, I'm sure you'll talk about the tax considerations in each of these, and we'll deal with that as a separate subject. But, we need to, especially given the changes in the Income Tax Act this year, there are various tax implications that, of course, would be triggered in an offshore transaction. In a listed transaction, if you're acquiring a foreign target that has an Indian listed company, this would amount to an indirect, could amount to an indirect change in control or an acquisition of shares that, you know, if it exceeds the relevant thresholds, which would require you to make an open offer in India. So these are the various laws that would get triggered in a structure like this. The third structure that we've seen typically is the foreign acquirer's Indian subsidiary acquiring the Indian target by way of a share acquisition. Now, this can be structured as a pure acquisition, or it could be structured as a merger, like the Sun Pharma Ranbaxy transaction. It could vary, and you know, the reason why you would do one over another has consequences or derives itself from tax considerations and also liability considerations that you would look at. Also, cash considerations, because in an all-stock deal, there is no requirement for actually paying cash. You could just do a merger and just have a stock being issued to the existing shareholders. So you have, you know, the Indian subsidiary acquiring a foreign or an Indian target. What we need to be aware of is that even any subsidiary of a foreign acquirer still has to comply with FEMA requirements. That means even in this sort of a deal, you would have to go to FIPB for the transaction, because the law in India is quite clear that any downstream investment by an entity that is either owned or controlled by a foreign acquirer needs to comply with the same laws that the foreign acquirer would have had to. So this would typically be a downstream investment where you need to comply with the FEMA. So in this situation also, you know, Competition Act would trigger. Nothing new, it would trigger irrespective. You still have Companies Act requirements. If it's a scheme of merger and amalgamation, it's a court-driven process, so you need the approval of the High Court. You also need the approval of shareholders as well as lenders, which is through the court process. If it is a listed company, you also now require the approval of SEBI pursuant to circular issued in 2013. So you have a whole lot of approvals that are required if it's a merger or if it's a share acquisition. I think the last structure which we've seen a couple of deals in the recent past is an acquisition of assets alone. And typically we see, you know, large MNCs when they want to sort of diversify or they want to divest certain assets, it is a part of their global or part of their portfolio that they want to divest. It could be because they want to focus on one over the other, you know, like we've seen in the Abbott Pyramid deal, we've seen in the Cipla deal recently, where they're divesting a part of their portfolio really to another investor. You have a hive off of the assets into another company. That hive off can be by way of a slump sale, can be by way of an asset sale. Again, both having tax implications or you know, tax consequences. It could also be by way of demerger, but you know, it may not really be efficient, because in a demerger you need to, technically speaking, give shares to the existing shareholders of the transferor entity. So this is another way of actually transacting, where the company that is divesting its portfolio transfers its assets to a new company, and the new company and then just merely sells off the shares to the acquirer. Or on the flip side, the acquirer acquires the assets directly through an Indian target, and the Indian target just does an asset acquisition. Again, you know, all the laws that we talked about earlier, whether it's the FEMA, if it is a share a transfer of assets and then a share acquisition, FEMA definitely comes into being. If it's a foreign acquirer, you know, the CCI you talked about is the same implication. Companies Act also is the same implication. Now, I think in terms of I think the FEMA, there have been, you know, different views in the market on whether FIPB would be applicable if you just structure this as a pure acquisition of assets. And the reason I take you back to our first discussion that although a greenfield investment is exempt from seeking FIPB approval, a brownfield is not. Therefore, if you just acquire assets and start such a company, the FIPB is now taking a view that is technically speaking acquiring a brownfield venture, which requires the approval of the FIPB. So although the FDI policy says acquisition of shares or voting rights or control, you know, you need to go to FIPB, in this circumstance, the FIPB is taking the view that you know, if you have an Indian company already incorporated and you're acquiring a brownfield venture, you know, you could require the FIPB, the approval of the FIPB. I think in addition to these two structures, or these four structures, we've seen, two or three innovative structures that are being used. Maybe Gaudi can talk about it. One is a situation where just specific brands are acquired by one company from another. The second would be a collaboration arrangement with respect to certain formulations or assets. And the third, which has been, you know, very interesting, is the GSK Novartis kind of deal, where, you know, in terms of where you want to sort of concentrate on one product portfolio as opposed to another, you do an exchange of assets one for another, and accordingly sort of concentrate your efforts on the product portfolio that you do best. So in all, Anishal, these are the kind of deals that you've seen.
I think one clarification that came in recently, in relation to the medical device, since you have spoken about the requirement of Foreign Investment Promotion Board approval, there was always a gray area whether for medical device sector gets covered or not, and that has been clarified that that is not
be
included.
Automatic,
it can be included as an automatic
rule. Yeah. Absolutely. And separately, sure. I think if you're talking about pharmaceutical industry, you also talk about chemists, which, you know, the FIPB is now taking a view that chemists would be typically retail, not really, you can't really have FDI in that, because it would be multi-brand retail from a chemist perspective. Chemists housed within hospitals would have a different flavor completely. Right. So the main activity is not really
So this is pharmacy.
Pharmacy.
Yeah, okay. So So just to add to what Simon said, I think in each of these structures, the tax considerations become very important. And the first question which is typically asked by clients, especially when the client is a foreign acquirer, is whether they should do a share acquisition or should it be a transfer of business from the seller. Some of the considerations which should be kept in mind for choosing between share acquisition and business transfer or what we call slump sale in India are as follows. Number one, it is easier to implement a share acquisition transaction as compared to a business transfer or slump sale transaction. Because in a share transfer, once the board takes the share transfer on record, you know, the share transfer is pretty much done. As compared to that, in case of a slump sale, you may also be required to transfer the registrations with respect to that business, approach the local authorities at times to get the registrations transferred, and that at times could be a time-consuming process. Also, at times there are certain licenses which are not transferable, which means the first the licenses need to be surrendered and then new licenses need to be taken in the acquirer's name. So that also at times could be a cumbersome process. The second distinguishing factor in case of to decide whether it should be a share purchase or a business purchase is the stamp duty. In case of share purchase transactions, the shares are not in DMAT form. The maximum stamp duty which is applicable is 0.25% of the total consideration which is paid for the acquisition. As compared to that, if there is a business purchase, the stamp duty could go to as low as, you know, it could be 3%, or in certain states it has also been 7 to 9 or 10% also. So from a stamp duty perspective, a slump sale or a business purchase is more expensive as compared to a share purchase. The third distinguishing feature is in case of share purchase, the acquirer does not get step up on the cost of acquisition for the assets. So let's say the book value of the target company is $100, but the acquirer is acquiring shares of the company for $200. The assets in the books of the target company still appear at $100. So tomorrow, if the target company sells the assets for $150, even though the acquirer acquired the shares for $200, there will still be a gain of $50 for the target company, which is also one of the reasons why a lot of acquirers prefer to structure their transaction as business purchase, because when they acquire the business of $100 for $200, they are able to record $200 in their books as cost of acquisition of the assets and are able to claim depreciation benefits on $200 as compared to $100 in case of share purchase. One of the other distinguishing features of share purchase as compared to asset purchase is also in situations where you want to carve out your assets, certain assets as compared to transferring the entire business of the company, there is no option but to do a business purchase as compared to share purchase, because you are retaining one business and selling the other business. The fifth situation in which we have seen the acquirers being more comfortable with business purchase as compared to share purchase is especially in a situation where the seller is a listed company. The problem with acquiring shares of a listed company is that the acquirer has to make an open offer to the public shareholders, which is again a time-consuming process. It could entail a period of at least 3 to 4 months to consummate the entire open offer process. As compared to that, if you do a business purchase, then there is no requirement of open offer, or the takeover code also doesn't apply. And this is something which was done in the Abbott Piramal deal, where Abbott had explored a number of structures, including acquisition of shares of Piramal Healthcare. But since they were only interested in the healthcare solutions business of Piramal, what Abbott did was, it, through its Indian subsidiary, they just acquired the business through a business purchase or a slump sale from Piramal. That transaction didn't entail any open offer, or it didn't trigger takeover code, because the securities of the company were not involved, only the assets were purchased. So this is a classic way in which you can avoid open offer if you are looking at doing transaction with listed company. So broadly, these are the pros and cons of share purchase versus a business purchase, and depending on you know, the considerations of the acquirer, either of these can be chosen. From a seller's perspective, clearly share purchase works better as compared to business purchase, because in share purchase, the seller is able to directly take benefit of the capital gains, long-term capital gains tax benefit, as compared to a business purchase where the company first pays tax, and if the seller wants to take out, and if the shareholder of the seller wants to take out money, then again there is an additional layer of dividend distribution tax. So from seller's perspective, the share purchase works much better than business purchase, and that's why we always have this long discussion between seller and the buyer on what should be the mode of transfer, share purchase or a business purchase. And typically with some increase in the valuation, the what we have seen in majority of transactions, the sellers agree to a business purchase, because that's something that works for the acquirer, and they also get a higher price to cover for their taxes in situations where business purchase is to be implemented. As Simone mentioned, as in case of global transactions, and we have seen number of global transactions happening. As I mentioned, there are many US to US transactions which are happening, which have an Indian leg. So let's take an example where a US acquirer is acquiring a US target from a US seller. Now, on the face of it, there is nothing which is happening in India. Shares are of a foreign company, acquirer is a foreign acquirer, seller is a foreign seller. Then why should Indian law come into picture? Which is where the law was amended in 2012 under the Finance Act 2012, where it said that if the value of a foreign company shares is derived substantially from Indian company's assets, then even the transfer of foreign company shares will be subject to tax in India, and which is what we call, you know, Vodafone tax. We have heard a lot about Vodafone tax controversy. And of late, just in the last budget, there was some more clarity that was given to the entire Vodafone tax issue, although there is lots which is still missing. But what the law now says that if the value of assets of a foreign company or value of assets of Indian company is more than 51% of value of share assets of the foreign company, then even if there is a transfer outside India, the Indian tax authorities will have a right to tax those transactions. So it's very important to do this analysis on the valuation of the foreign company and Indian company when such type of transactions are there. So broadly, these are the deal structures that we have seen, in the M&A space. There are many nuances to it which one needs to be aware of. Let's, from the deal structuring, let's move on to the regulatory side. And Gauri, you have been an expert on advising clients on regulatory issues in pharma sector. Would you like to throw some light on what are the typical regulatory issues you have faced while representing the acquirer?
Sure. I think we need to first understand, what is the nature of the operation within India, based on which the regulatory issues, and of course the structure based on which the regulatory issues have to be dealt with. Before I get into the structure-related regulatory issues, I think what is extremely important in the Indian context and currently in the last couple of years, we have seen a spate of regulatory issues coming out whether it is pharma manufacturing, distribution, or even against the retail chain. There have been several issues that have been raised by the regulators, whether at the central level or at the state level. So one very important aspect, apart from looking at obviously, during the due diligence, all the licenses, the renewal status, because in India, most of the pharmaceutical, manufacturing or imports or related licenses are periodically renewed. So obviously you need to see, where the renewals stand and how they affect, if at all, during your, transaction, because sometimes if the renewal is going to happen while the transaction is closing, that is some transition one has to look into. So apart from looking into the licenses, one important issue is whether there has been any regulatory litigation against the company. And when we say regulatory litigation, it typically starts with a show cause notice. So whether the company has received any show cause notice, because sometimes what happens is in the beginning it seems very regular issue that has been raised, which may be answered, but sometimes it can get into, you know, right up to the suspension or cancellation of the licenses, and we actually have seen that happen in the last couple of years. Only recently, for example, Maharashtra FDA, that is the, you know, the local authority, has issued suspension notices to, you know, hundreds of the retail chains basically the pharmacies. So the way we would typically approach the due diligence, apart from the disclosures, from the target, in India we have something called as Right to Information Act. So we would use that to basically, actually find out from the regulators themselves, in each relevant jurisdiction, because you have certain licenses which are at the central level, especially, you know, typically the new drug licenses are at the central level. Manufacturing and, the generic sort of licenses are at the state level. So you would typically want to file a Right to Information application to figure out whether there are any, you know, regulatory issues that are growing at that stage as well. So this is, you know, very quickly on the due diligence aspect. Now coming to the structure that you and, you know, Simon discussed in detail, one interesting aspect, you know, when you look at any share acquisition, slum sale, of course, and the merger, there could be different regulatory issues, and you briefly mentioned about it. So I will deal with the pharma and medical devices related, licenses related issues and the others. I think there have been cases where, where it has been held that if there is a merger, share acquisition is pretty straightforward prima facie for the non-pharma licenses. But when it's a merger, there have been cases which says that unless the law otherwise specifies, typically in a merger situation, the licenses get transferred to the merged entity. You don't necessarily need, you know, additional separate sort of permissions or otherwise. But let's look at the specific pharma licenses, and this is where we find the issue. If there are license conditions which state that if there is any change in the constitution of the licensee, in that case you have been given 3 months' time to get a completely new license. Now it is not only the change of name, right? So the filing and all that will have to be, appropriately done. You have a 3 month period within which you can, you need to basically get a new license. So in slum sale, it is obvious because it's a new entity, that new entity is going to require a license. But in case even of a share transfer, one has to bear in mind that a new license in the same entity will be required, and that particular process will be followed. I know it's not necessarily relating to an M&A deal, but interestingly, we have seen even a change of director is held to be a change in constitution, though we do not agree with that proposition, and we have actually made a representation to the DCGI, which is the Drug Controller General of India's office, that merely a change in the directorship should not be held as a change in control. But that's one interesting aspect to be looked into. Now coming to the other structure that was discussed, right? So you have a local entity whose shareholder, so there is a possibility that the actual transfer or the transaction is happening at the grandfather level, not a parent entity level. Probably a view could be taken that the immediate shareholder of the Indian entity remains the same. If it's only changed in at the grandfather level, then you don't necessarily need to go to the regulator because the immediate entity remains the same. But this is one aspect from a timing perspective, especially in the slum sale. If the new entity doesn't have relevant licenses, then the timing becomes a problem. And what we have seen from a structure perspective is if the new entity yet doesn't have the licenses, say, but the brand has been transferred, right? Or people have already been transferred, you know, relevant to the brand. So then what happens, till the new entity gets its licenses, then you typically have a interim agreement, shared services or otherwise, where, the outsourcing happens. But here we have a concept called loan license. So if you are a manufacturer, you don't have your manufacturing facility, and you're loaning from a third party the manufacturing facility, then you have a concept of loan license. So, you know, keeping all these things in mind, we need to understand that when there is a slum sale, or an asset sale in this case, whether the manufacturing facility is going to get transferred. If not, then if it's only going to be an outsourcing to the same seller entity for a period till the new manufacturing facility is set up, and of course in India it does take time. So all these structuring aspects have to be taken into account when you are doing the structuring. I mean, of course you discuss the tax issues, Simon discussed the FDI, but often we have seen that last minute all these issues come up. So at the time of structuring and even including the commercials, this has to be sorted. The other interesting issue is on the distribution chain. In India, it is extremely important that as a part of the transaction, you have your distribution chain also coming up with you as a part of the slum sale. So obviously you have, because luckily the distributors will have their own licenses in place. So you are able to take a complete piggyback ride. You just transfer the distribution agreements. Nothing really needs to change because their licenses are not dependent on you. The other, I know I'm going slightly in detail, but I think the other interesting issue is on the clinical trial. In the pharmaceutical sector, clinical trial has become a very sort of a sore point in the Indian context in last few years because of the compensation related guidelines and the laboratories allocation. So there is a possibility that as a part of certain transactions, the clinical trial approvals are also getting transferred. Now, what typically happens is if you have an adverse effect or a death or otherwise which is relating to a clinical trial, the law today says that the sponsor or the CRO, both of them will be held liable to pay the compensation. So here we clearly need to understand what have been the regulatory filings. Have there been any deaths reported? Have there been any adverse events reported? So all this due diligence has to be looked into, and accordingly the indemnities etc. will have to be negotiated. So that is another point. The last point probably I will deal with is the hospital, and Dr. Anzani probably can add here. Is in India, a lot of the hospitals are set up more like a trust, under the trust structure. And if there is a consolidation that is being contemplated of various hospitals in any transaction, then that comes in the way of, consolidation, because you have a trust which is a not-for-profit and there are other entities who may be having hospitals which are held under some other structure. So that becomes a little tricky. You have to look at the trust deed. Also, sometimes the land is given by the government. Very interestingly, in one of the transactions, when the land is allocated, by the government to the hospitals, they have certain specific requirements of certain beds being available at a particular price point. Now that affects the commercial, when you are looking at a particular deal of a hospital. So, these are some of the issues which may seemingly appear, to be routine when you get into the due diligence, but it definitely has an impact on the speed of the transaction,
sure,
as well as the commercial. So, unless Dr. Anzani wants to add something.
Your point on trust deed, I think as you mentioned, almost 60-70% of the big hospitals where such transactions do happen are constructed, so there are always some interest in real estate of the hospital when such transactions do happen. And in experience, we have seen that there are so many restrictions the trust deed has.
Mm.
In fact, in another example, of course, one Gauri mentioned, that there was a clear-cut restriction on constructing any other building, which really put a huge brake on future expansion. And we really had to negotiate through there to meet the authorities again and have some amendment in trust deed. So trust deed becomes a very big issue. Another issue in healthcare sector, we have seen where another lot of traction we have seen is private hospitals, where the relationship between hospital, the company which is going to be acquired, and the doctors who are running the show, there's a very big deficit in the relationship. So there is instance, in fact, one transaction, it happened that, and we could observe that, though the acquisition happened, but there was no control of the company over the doctor, the possibility of doctor who was one of the shareholders of the company may not continue his services, which is very crucial for the business to go.
Mm.
So this is another issue I think Acquire has to keep in mind.
Interesting. So Simon, I think one of the important things in pharma industry has been the competition law, or what is called the antitrust issue. Would you like to throw some light on, especially in mergers and acquisitions, or in the due diligence with respect to competition law, what all things one needs to keep in mind vis-a-vis the company? And a lot of times these pharma companies are part of industry associations. So anything from a due diligence perspective one needs to look at to ensure that there is no possibility of a cartelization penalty or a fine which would be imposed on the pharma company on which the due diligence is happening. Your thoughts on that?
Sure. So, Michelle, I mean, I think we could spend 2 days discussing the competition law issues in pharma industry, especially given the fact that, you know, the most amount of transactions are being done by strategics, and that is where, you know, the problem consistently lies. But let's divide this, you know, this discussion into the following parts. Let's discuss first, you know, given the Indian context, what happens in an M&A deal, and what we see in terms of the combination regulations and how the CCI is looking at M&A. We will then discuss, you know, in terms of what has happened vis-a-vis associations, and, you know, what the CCI has looked at in terms of associations. So what an acquirer needs to be careful, you know, when diligencing a company. And I think third, we can sort of discuss other aspects with respect to what sort of agreements pharma companies enter into, and the interplay between IP laws and competition laws, which actually sort of, you know, are work in opposite directions. So let's start with M&A. I think the first aspect to discuss, or to sort of, you know, since we have a live example, is the entire Sun Pharma Ranbaxy transaction, which when we saw the CCI at the first time look into a phase two investigation. Now, the way our laws are divided, are looked at, or the Competition Act works, is that within 30 days of you entering into a binding document, and the reason why I stress on this binding document is, you know, we'll discuss this later. The minute you enter into a binding document, within 30 days of that document being signed, and in the event of a merger or amalgamation, within 30 days, the board of directors actually making a decision to merge or amalgamate, you need to make a filing with the Competition Commission of India. The Competition Commission of India then technically has 30 working days to look at the transaction and give a prima facie view whether or not, you know, they think that the combination of the transaction has an appreciable adverse effect in competition or not. If the CCI answers in the negative, that means they don't really think that the entire transaction would have an appreciable adverse effect on competition, then you're through. The transaction can go ahead. If they decide that they still are in doubt and they need more information, that's when the phase two investigation starts, and the CCI can sort of dig deeper and inquire and into more in more detail. And that is what happened in the Sun Pharma Ranbaxy case, where, you know, subsequent to this, I think Sun Pharma has become now one of the largest pharmaceutical company in India. And therefore, of course, given the sensitivity of the sector, given the impact of the sector on, the CCI did a phase two investigation. There were a lot of overlaps which the CCI looked at in terms of horizontal overlaps, which the Competition Commission of India looked at in terms of various products. And although they approved the transaction, the approval was conditional. It was conditional on the divestiture of certain products, to the market. So that is what the CCI looked at. Now, in terms of how they arrived at what products to sort of divest, they looked at the relevant market. Now, the entire concept of relevant market goes to product based as well as geographically based. So, they looked at they looked at this and asked for certain divestitures of certain products. And the transaction went through. So that's how the CCI is looking at, you know, cases, specifically the specifically pharmaceutical cases. Now, if you go back historically, when it was decided that brownfield investments require the FIPB approval, the question was, or required an approval, especially for an investor, the question then arose as to whether it should be the FIPB that decides these aspects, or whether the CCI should actually decide these aspects, because largely the concern is on the competition in the market and, you know, of course, pricing. And maybe, Gauri, you can sort of discuss those, you know, price control orders that have an impact on the sector, but largely these were the concerns of the government. It was finally sort of decided that it would be the FIPB that looked at, you know, FDI concerns and not the CCI, but that went through a lot of debate, on account of which a lot of pharma deals were actually stuck for approval. The second bit that is very important in terms of the pharma deal is the fact that given the magnitude of investors, magnitude of size of companies that are being acquired, size of portfolio of companies that are being acquired, typically these transactions require not just CCI but also the FIPB approval. Now, when you have so many regulators, the question is, you know, and in terms of the timing of the deal, when do you actually notify the CCI? The question then arises is, you know, when have you entered into a binding commitment? Because largely, you know, the FIPB approval is not a sure shot. There have been cases where FIPB has rejected, you know, foreign investors investing into pharmaceutical companies. And therefore, it is not clear whether or not the transaction will actually go through or not. Since this is, you know, maybe not approval, what we've seen acquirers do is first approach the FIPB and say, look, you know, this is what we're trying to do, give us approval, and if the approval comes through, then you enter into a binding document to actually acquire, and so on and so forth. The question has arose with respect to the CCI, and this was, you know, in a different context in terms of the Tesco deal, where, you know, the question that arose is whether the minute you make an application to the FIPB, does that convey that you have actually entered into a binding commitment to actually invest and thereby trigger the CCI approval, or the clock starts ticking for the CCI approval. If you do not file within time, there are, you know, draconian penalties that could be imposed on you. So in this situation, you know, I think there have been many battles fought with respect to what should come first, but I think the law has now sort of been amended to exclude specifically, or to include only applications or approvals to statutory authorities as evidence that a binding commitment has been reached. Now, the Foreign Investment Promotion Board, you know, whether it is a statutory authority or not, is again a difficult question, because the FIPB is nothing but a function of the government. It's another arm of the government. It is not really a creature of statute, really speaking. So, you know, one could argue that the FIPB, technically speaking, is not a statutory authority, and therefore, you know, the trigger with respect to making a binding commitment should not trigger from the time you make an application to the FIPB. Again, you know, not very clear, but this is one circumstance that one has to deal with in an M&A transaction, at least a foreign acquirer. The second bit that we want to discuss is the non-compete bit for an M&A transaction. Now, the FIPB is very clear that if typically when you make an investment into a brownfield pharmaceutical company, you can't really have a non-compete unless the FIPB, thinks it's absolutely required and you seek a specific permission from the FIPB in this situation. The CCI, again, looks at non-compete very, with a lot of scrutiny. In this situation, I suppose, because the law already prescribes no non-compete, you know, the CCI view and the FIPB view go hand in hand. So any transaction, even if you don't really require an FIPB approval, only require CCI approval in terms of domestic acquisition, the CCI looks at non-compete pharma companies in a much stricter light as opposed to other sectors. So
That's on the M&A front. I think in terms of the associations and in terms of agreements being entered into, associations now, you know, we've all heard of the various chemist cases where the CPI has penalized associations for acting, you know, in an abusive manner, for cartelization and so on and so forth. So, you know, associations play a very important role in the pharmaceutical industry. But the CCI has been mindful of the fact that, you know, you cannot have an association that prevents another or a non-member, especially in the pharmacy segment, or the chemist segment, from accessing the market just because you do not really belong to that association. There have been penalties for abuse of dominance in that situation where you act as a dominant entity, not really permitting others to function in the way they should. So an excessive power being exercised by the association. Now, whether the CCI order has changed drastically the way the industry works is again a question of fact, which, you know, one may not really be able to determine at this point, but at least the Competition Commission of India is extremely mindful of these acts. Again, I think a lot of questions are being asked on exclusivity arrangements that are being entered into by pharma companies and whether or not the exception under the Competition Act, which deals with anti-competitive agreements, saying that if you enter into an agreement today for the protect which is to protect your IP on furtherance of a protection of IP laws, that technically speaking is not a violation of the anti-competitive agreements provisions of the Act. So you know, I don't think we've had a square case where the CCI has actually taken a view on these aspects. But you know, if you structure an agreement or that's strictly necessary for the protection of IP, there's a direct carve out. Having said that, you know, it doesn't mean that that entities can just enter into price parcels or exclusive agreements in terms of vertical restraints with each other. So I think there's a lot of jurisprudence that is being developed on these aspects, but there are concerns in terms of this industry.
I think one more model that is developing, though it is not specifically in a strict sense of M&A, but more like a coming together or a collaboration, is the joint marketing agreement, where also we are, you know, beginning to see whether there is any competition or issue where the same molecule under different brand names is marketed by two different companies under a certain understanding. And then, you know, there is always a question whether you can determine a particular price, not determine a price, you know, what should be that sort of a relationship. And those type of deals we are, you know, beginning to sort of see. And there also some of the competition issues come into arise.
Yeah. And just like in any other field where two competitors are acquiring each other, you know, in terms of sharing of information, whether this could be, you know, perceived to be anti-competitive. Now, our regulator has not really prescribed regulations as to how competitors must share information with respect, especially in M&A transactions. But, you know, it's safe to say that we need to be careful. Should the deal not go through, you know, what is the amount of information that has actually passed from one entity to another? And could this really be in violation, or could this affect how prices, how distribution, how sale, etc., are done going forward? So, you know, in conducting a diligence, especially where you have you know, competitor entities looking into information from another, we need to be careful as to what information goes from one competitor to another, which is the same in any deal that you're doing in terms of in the assets.
Yeah, Nishit, one point on pricing thing, especially when M&A is happening in a formulation space, where company is very active in formulation, especially generic, only around 340 products are in price control, which is the national list of essential medicines, and over a period of time, it is likely to expand to include another 100 or 200. So when such transaction is happening, it is very important for the acquirer to know how many products are really into price control, which can really jeopardize the ultimate revenue model.
I think the other, just to add on price control, because, you know, one doesn't realize that there is a particular provision that if a certain type of molecule has had certain history of price increase, then the regulator can control, even if not listed
in the
schedule.
And there are litigations
to
the different
courts. We have had these, you know, in the recent past, in the gliptin space, there have been some issues on that. Right?
Okay.
So that is also, it is not only what is in the list, but you need to do an analysis molecule-wise on the price aspect.
Understood.
Yeah. In addition, I think in the industry, there's been a recent penalty by the CCI on pharma companies in terms of a bid rigging situation.
Yes.
Right.
Where, you know, they were in terms of...
For the government tenders.
Correct, for the government tenders, exactly. So I think that's another... but it's not really, you know, akin to or particular with respect to this industry. I think there are various industries that have been caught with this bid rigging situation in terms of tenders. But, you know, this has been one such industry that has been, where cases have actually been decided.
Yeah, I think talking about one more aspect on government tenders, because this becomes extremely important, and I should have discussed it before, is we spoke about distribution relationships getting transferred contractually, but the government tenders may actually have restrictive clauses on transfer.
Mm.
So, you know, we recently had a situation where we had to analyze various tender documents to see whether in a particular transaction can the tenders can be transferred. Some tenders may be in transition at the time of closing. How do we deal with those? So that is, you know, one more aspect to be kept in mind, because if the majority of the business is a tender business, it could create an impact on the value of the transaction, whether or not those can be transferred.
I think this is very important. This will be more on a hospital side, where especially equipment and medical device sector, where almost 70 to 80% of the business comes from government hospital supply.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that is where I think very much. I think similar thing can happen into pharma also, where a lot of times it goes to government programs or defense. There are various companies in India which generate revenue only or providing supply to only defense in India.
Mm-hmm.
Almost 70 to 80% revenues come from them. So that is where the contract will play significant role if the change of control changes.
Understood. My next question is to you, Gauri.
Yeah.
I think intellectual property is at the heart of M&As in the pharma sector. What are the IP issues which the acquirer should take care of when, you know, if conducting diligence on the pharma company, or when we have, let's say, when structuring issues for IP?
Do I have one more hour?
Yes, yeah.
Because I think in the Indian context, basically, you know, there have been a lot of perceptions about, first of all, protection of IP in India, right? That, I think one thing before I get into the issues, I want to clarify, the IP laws are TRIPS compliant. You go to the court at the right time, you are able to get, you know, interim relief as well. And we have had these, injunctions that have been granted, whether for trademark or, you know, other IP. But put the IP in three buckets, at least for the pharma sector, is the trademark, patents, and the know-how. Before I get into the specifics, I think a couple of items. When we do due diligence, especially if it's a group entity, what we have noticed in the Indian context is that sometimes IP is scattered. So if of a particular business during due diligence, you have to identify what is the key IP and where is the IP residing within the group. Because when the filings are done, you know, the companies may not be cognizant as to, you know, they should have IP only in one entity. That is one. Number two, the understanding, and depends, you know, suppose you are sort of, it's a small biologic company, or, you know, it's a startup where you are acquiring. The understanding of IP itself is sometimes, you know, not up to the level where it should be. And therefore, even during the due diligence, the disclosures that you will get may not be up to the mark, right? So that's one segment of startups or trams, you know, which industries not that conversant with the IP. Of course, when you have multinationals, having transactions in India, that should not be a problem. But we typically have seen this issue. The third is in the development phase, a couple of things. There are quite a few Indian companies who may be in the co-development relationship with the MNC. So sometimes when you look at the IP, you need to really dig into
whether and to what extent the company really owns the IP, because it may actually be with, you know, co-development with the other, you know, companies. The fourth one is the university funded IP. In India, we don't have that, you know, sort of developed or sort of a legal regime on university funded IP and who should own, etc. So you really need to understand contractually whether the government, relevant government department has a policy. You have some, you know, some of the biodiversity department, you know, funding some developments, etc. So we have to be slightly mindful of those aspects. Coming back to, you know, to the actual IP issues before I get into the, you know, the trademark and patents, let me just quickly deal with know-how. Because for know-how, we don't have a law in India. So everything is contractual. In the, when you look at any R&D focused company, I'm not, you know, I mean, this is based on experience. What you have seen is sometimes, you know, recently one of our clients, for example, got a legal notice because the employee had moved from a competitor to their company, and he may have taken the same project where he was working, has been brought into this company. And that may or may not be with the intention to violate, because sometimes employees themselves don't understand. So you need to see what are the internal processes apart from the documentation, you know, the confidentiality documentation, what are the processes set in-house so that the third-party IP is not violated. And the example which I gave was in fact in the pharmaceutical sector. So that is one very, very important aspect, which is more on the, not so much on the law, but on the processes, because, you know, when there is a claim, you know, you have to be mindful, you know, how to deal with that. Coming to patents. Now, that has been a sore point again in the Indian context. A couple of quick things. When you are doing a due diligence, apart from merely saying whether or not the patent has been issued in so-and-so's name or has been filed in so-and-so's name, what is required and which typically is done also in other jurisdictions is the actual analysis of the validity of the patent. Only because the patent has been issued does not necessarily mean that it will remain valid, and we have had situations where one can actually go for cancellation, right? So the validity of the claim under the Indian context, because India law is slightly different on the patentability. We have had the 3E issue, which we can probably deal in some other webinar. Coming to the other interesting aspect is the compulsory license. That also becomes a problem. The reason being, you will often find that MNC will register patents in India, but will not exploit in India. And because of such issue, they become exposed to compulsory license. So from the 3-year period, from the date of grant, if you have not done anything to work that invention in India, right, which is protected, that means it becomes open to compulsory license, though we have had only one case of compulsory license till date, but that exposure remains. Right, so that is another aspect, especially in the Indian context, and how do you look at that is there are certain forms that the patent is required to file with the patent office from which you can, during the due diligence, find this out. Coming to the trademarks, I don't want to spend too much time, but obviously you will look into the registrations and all of that, and their invalidity is not so much of an issue. But what we have seen in the trademark context is that sometimes parties don't realize that under the Indian law, there are two separate manners in which the trademark can be transferred. One is with the goodwill of the business to which the trademark gets connected, and one without. If the document doesn't specify that it is with the goodwill of the business, there is a certain consequence. You have to actually advertise in the newspapers, invite public objections. If nobody objects, then only can the transfer be registered. So this one aspect, you know, from a documentation perspective, most of the times, yes, it is with the goodwill of the business, but if it is not mentioned, could create some issues. Of course, you know, in the recent past, again, we have had these situations where the same trademark in a transaction, the parties want to break it up. In the sense, for certain products, the earlier party will continue, and for the other products, the other parties will continue. I mean, the acquirer will continue. That's something which in the Indian context is not possible without the trademark office permission, and which basically because, you know, the consumer confusion should not occur. So that is one, you know, thing to be kept in mind.
there are certain trademarks which are associated with each other. You can't break them up again. You have to transfer them as a whole. So these are quickly some of the issues. One other thing is we have noticed that, sometimes in a global deal, the trademarks sometimes may be actually local trademarks may be registered in the local entity of the company. But when you go global deal, sometimes the acquirer wants to house the entire IP in their local IP holding entity. So therefore, there is a break in the in the deal where the IP is transferred offshore and all the other assets are locally transferred. In this case, a slump sale scenario is impossible, right? So that is one aspect to be kept in mind, because you can't say that the IP is getting transferred elsewhere and but still this is a slump sale. And there the valuation also from a FEMA, Foreign Exchange Management Act perspective, when you're splitting the consideration, it should not be viewed that what is due to either party is actually being given to the other party.
Correct.
So, those are, typical issues we have seen, in a transaction document, and quite a few times these issues arise. Sometimes the authorized dealers take a view that if there is a transfer of IP outside India, then a permission is required at the IR, but we have taken a view that, not necessary.
So, just one point. I think before we discuss asset acquisition, other acquisition, but in pharmaceutical, brand acquisition is a very important thing. So, can you just spend 3-4 minutes on your experience on brand acquisition? What are the issues and what we need to be careful about?
I think I've discussed most of them, right now. But I think one important thing is, on the recorded of rights. That's something sometimes, parties don't realize that they need to do record of rights, but there have been cases that pending the record of rights, whether the acquirer can sue for infringement, and the answer is yes, one can sue for infringement, so that should not be too much of a concern. So I think the other point probably when if you have more time,
can
deal
with. Sure.
So
my next question is to you, Dr. Andani. You have been advising a lot of pharma clients on industry issues. Would you like to share some of the typical examples which you faced on deals where not only your legal advice but even your commercial advice helped the client?
Yeah, sure. I think most of the issues we have covered, especially what we have seen and what I've experienced, is most of the concerns which really arise during the transactions are purely on a regulatory side, and that is where I think the non-compliance or non-documentation is one of the major issue. And one example Gopi recently shared was one of the company where global acquisition happened, and the Indian entity was very active, though they have both private as well as government contract model. They were seriously concerned about what will happen to their existing contracts with government, and that is where I think we really needed to navigate through on certain points, because the closing has to happen after 3 months, and what happens to them, what happens after closing on those contracts. That is one thing. Another thing on one example, one incident I'm reminded of was one transaction was happening where CRO was getting involved. And that is where, while doing due diligence, and we saw that the CRO is usually works on a contract work, and they were doing into mainly medicinal chemistry work. And they were working with more than one company. That is what their business model is. And in one of the contracts, we found out that the CRO had given a blanket indemnity to the company, that anything and everything that happens during the contract, we indemnify for it, which became a very big issue. And so the point is, when you are acquiring such companies, such a small important point, so we need to work out. On healthcare side, we had two very interesting incidences, and that is where I think, though it may appear very trivial, but a simple or a mere not following the documentation submission to the government as per government requirement. There is a simple MTP Act, which is Medical Termination Pregnancy Act. And in one of the transactions, we observed that there was some lapse on submission of the certain filings, and it become a very big issue. And an MTP for other countries, especially in Europe and US, abortion is a very big point of concern on culture as well as ethics, and it almost become a deal breaker. And we just really had to navigate through. Another important point we have seen is there is one very onerous act on healthcare, which is PCP NDT, which is post preconception and prenatal diagnostic techniques, which prohibits all the doctors not to indulge into sex discrimination of a pregnant woman. And this is not doctor driven, this is machine driven. So any hospital which has a sonography machine has to comply with this. Even if there is a sonography machine which is in a surgery department, doesn't have gynecology department, also have to comply with such compliance. It could be nil reporting, but that nil reporting is very important. And there are instances, there are 3-4 doctors in jail also because of simple non-compliance. Another recently we came across was another medtech sector, where acquisition was happening, and the issues on online sale of drugs, whether the model was providing medications to the patients at home, and there was some non-compliance with various laws on data privacy as well as Drugs and Cosmetics Act, which prohibits online pharmacy. So these are various issues that really we came across. So what I wanted to message is that documentation and regulatory compliance becomes a very, very key role.
Sure. Thanks, Dr. Anthan. So my last question would be to all three of you, if you can just share your thoughts on what, as per you, would be the do's and don'ts for any acquirer to do M&A in Indian pharma sector.
Okay, so...
Wait 2 minutes for all of
us. Sure. So I think I would emphasize on the conduct of diligence. We've learned from the Daiichi Ranbaxy situation how important diligence really is, and especially where as we started off this webinar, saying that one of the reasons for making an acquisition is the product pipeline. It's important to ensure that the product pipeline is exactly what you think, and there are no unforeseen surprises, at least from a US FDA perspective. So. Whether it is to do just a commercial diligence or do a forensic diligence, I think I would emphasize on the aspect of doing the diligence. Strategy and structuring a deal is of course very important, but that is not specific to a pharma deal. It's specific. It's everywhere. Right. I don't think we discussed IP holding companies, but that's another aspect to be wary of in an IP heavy industry like the pharma industry. And third is, in terms of seeking FIPB approval, I think it's important to sort of try and forecast for the future, because whether it's for the first tranche, second tranche, every tranche of investment today in Indian pharma company may require an FIPB approval. So it's important to sort of forecast for the future, so that you don't have multiple approvals time and time and again when you need to put in equity into a company. So forecast for the future and ensure that the first approval that goes through has leeway for you to sort of make investments without seeking the FIPB approval.
Sure.
So I think those are the things. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think just to add to what Simon said on the due diligence, what we have seen sometimes is the forensic, legal, and financial due diligence work independently. So the more the teams, all the teams talk to each other, especially in the regulated field, sometimes, some indication from one quarter may, sort of give the other quarter to dig deep in a particular issue. That is very important. Second, coming to the IP, I think if there are, IP, that if there is IP litigation, ongoing IP litigation, or at a notice stage, to the extent possible, one should try to have a condition precedent that the IP dispute should be settled. If that, those are the type of disputes that really can be settled up. I think because no acquirer wants to inherit litigation. Right? And the third one is because the regulatory area is, there are some places we find that it's gray on how it would be implemented, some of the transactional issues. So when you have a definitive agreement signed and before closing, I think it's good to have a dialogue with the regulator, and today it is possible, you know, keeping in mind all your FCP and all those considerations in mind, it is still possible to have that dialogue with the regulator so that you get their blessing, you know, whether you're thinking about a particular manner in which you're going to sort of consummate the transaction from a regulatory perspective is something, you know, they are fine with. I think that becomes an important aspect.
Okay.
Most of the things on legal and regulatory side are covered, so I think I will shift my gears from there to other things from my experience. But on regulatory, I think one thing everybody may not agree, but most important thing is many times acquirer relies a lot on issue-based diligence. So we have to be very judicious whether you want issue-based diligence or you want full diligence to have the best thing. But coming back to other do's and don'ts, I think two do's I want to say that do anticipate consequences and prepare, whether it is acquirer or a seller, it is very important. And when such transactions happen, so it is very important that you do understand the differences as early as possible and resolve them. And on don't have these two things, that don't ignore regulatory compliance and documentation. And the most important, we have not discussed possibly because of the time constraint, don't ignore your key employees, which are going to play a significant role in the transaction.
Okay. Thanks to all of you. We can open the floor for questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, we will now begin the question and answer session. Anyone wishing to ask a question may please press star and one on their touchtone telephone. If you wish to remove yourself from the question queue, you may press star and two. Participants are requested to use handsets while asking a question. Ladies and gentlemen, we will wait for a moment while the question queue assembles. Reminder to the participants, anyone wishing to ask a question may please press star and one on their touchtone telephone. First question is from the line of Shipra from Dr. Reddy's. Please go ahead.
Okay, hi. Thank you, everyone. It was really valuable for a person like me. So my question is with regards to business purchase and share purchase. So as it was clearly stated by the panel that it's always beneficial to undergo share purchase instead of business purchase. So I wanted to understand what the difference between business purchase and share purchase is, because as per the term per se, share purchase means a share. However, business means a business in itself. So if you could just highlight on that, it would be really great.
Sure. So basically what we say when we say share purchase, it means you are acquiring the shares of the target company. And when we say business purchase, means you are acquiring the assets and liabilities of the target company. And what we said was from acquirer's perspective, there are a lot of advantages to structuring the transaction as a business purchase because you are just acquiring the assets and liabilities. From a seller's perspective, the share purchase works better from a tax because of the tax issues. So this is the main difference between a share purchase and a business purchase.
And just to sort of add, you know, the difference, I mean, you basically the question is whether you want to acquire the existing entity as a whole, meaning to say if you just acquire the shares, you stand in place of the seller, you know, as if the seller was never there. So you continue with the company as a whole, as opposed to doing a business purchase where, you know, you may acquire some aspects of the business and not the entire entity as a whole. And you carve it out from the existing entity, carve it out into something else, and then acquire that entity. You know, so there are different considerations, as Mr. said, but this is something that, you know, another difference.
Okay, fine. Thanks.
Thank you. A reminder to the participants, anyone wishing to ask a question, may please press star and one on the touchtone telephone. Participants, in order to ask a question, you may please press star and one on your touchtone telephone. Participants who wish to ask a question may please press star and one at this time.
If there are no more questions, we can maybe close the call.
Yeah. So thanks to all the participants for joining this webinar. This webinar will be uploaded on our mobile app, Nishit Mobile, in a couple of days. So the same can be accessed by people who were not able to attend. Till then, you know, have a great day. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, with that, we conclude this conference. Thank you for joining us, and you may now disconnect your lines.